see if we can work the rest of it. It's kind of, it's a good issue.
Good morning, all. We have two bills before us today. I am not sure they're going to take the whole time, but you all will guide that, not me. First up is, formally call the meeting to order. First up is House File 2640, Representative Erickson. And this is, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 2640.
And that it be referred to our Capital Investment Committee.
Correct.
You begin.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm presenting House File 2640, which is a bill for the seed processing complexes, both at Bedora and General Andrews. I stopped by and visited the General or the Bedora site on Friday on my way home. It happens to be on my travels and one of my to-do lists. And I spent about 45 minutes walking around and admiring the ingenuity that they had when they tried to turn various machine products from what they were originally intended for to be able to be useful for their seed processing. We're asking for $2.8 million to help them provide native seed for conservation purposes and tree research. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Owen Phillips from the DNR Forestry Division to provide some more details.
Welcome.
Madam Chairman and representatives, my name's Olin Phillips. I'm the Forest Protection Section Manager for the Department of Natural Resources, and I've been in charge of the nursery program for many portions of my long career over there, so I've been here at it a long time. The Representative Erickson's bill here, the first thing I need to point out is it's not in the governor's budget. It is very similar to a proposal that we put forward as a possible bonding to the governor's office through the Minnesota Management Budget, but it did not end up in the governor's budget at that point in time. It is also very consistent with some options that were developed in a legislative report that we provided this year to you, and that is in your packets. And I will be referring to that if you wanted to pull it out. But this report was after discussions at the last legislative session about the nurseries and where they would be going in the future. We were called upon to produce this report. The purpose that we were given in producing the report was to, provide recommendations and options to ensure the long-term availability of ecologically appropriate and genetically diverse native forest seed and seedlings, to support state conservation projects and initiatives, protect the genetic fitness and resilience of native forest ecosystems, and support tree improvement research to address evolving pressures such as invasive species and climate change. This report goes into the background of those issues and how they are both impacting forestry and potentially will impact forestry, and also as to how they have they can be addressed through a nursery and tree improvement program. The first thing I'd like to point out is I think you'll see very clearly through this report that the undertaking to be successful in this response is not just going to be a public agency response. It's going to have to be our private nurseries, our private industries, all of our landowners as we move forward. And we hope that, we can develop a collaborative thrust here as we go forward and not try to do this just with a state infrastructure. I think the portion that Representative Erickson's bill puts forward is some of the more critical of the options that we've identified as we talk about the need for expanded tree improvement effort, and really the result of tree improvement is seed, and that's what the seed facility would assist in that. I would ask you to turn to page 14 of the report, and this is the section that talks about some of the improvements needed to meet Minnesota's challenges, and there's a several bullets there under improved seedling production, diversity, capacity, and distribution. You know, so increase the production of diverse seed sources and the variety of tree and forest plant species offered. Really, that comes to the heart of what Representative Erickson's bill would assist in doing. It would assist in our ability to address that issue for seed, and seed is one of the big ones. Also, you'll see that we need to invest in genetic studies and research, as it continues over on page 15, and some of the recommendations that have come out of this. And so the support for the greenhouse and lab facilities related to tree improvement also fit very well within the options for the state to invest in these efforts. And one of the changes in the state forest nursery program is that we have consolidated all of our bare root seedling production into the Bedora facility. That's also the site of our seed production. And we have been working over the last several years to repurpose the General Andrews Nursery site into a long-term tree improvement investment for the state, and establishing seed orchards there of genetically improved seedling and also native seed sources that we can move forward with. When we talk about, you know, how this relates to our existing program, the state forest nursery system has sufficient seed capacity to move forward to meet the production levels that we are basing our future on right now, which is about 6 million seedlings per year. And so we have that capability. But if we're going to address some of these issues that have been brought out in the report and options that are there, it's going to take some investments that go beyond the self-sustaining structure of the state forest nursery system. And so this is one of some of the options we identified, and they didn't include financial investments, and we're called to identify those potential financial investments in it. You know, I think if you just to turn you back to page 14 and repeat again, you know, it says in the top paragraph there, the last sentence, the following improvements will only be met through the efforts of both public and private nurseries. One of the emphasis of this bonding bill that would kind of meet that goal is that we would be producing seed that would not only be available for the purpose of the state forest nurseries, but also available for all nurseries across the state to draw from that capability and to move forward in production. The tree improvement effort itself also would be kind of unilateral across all potential growers of regeneration materials for our forest. And I think that is one of the reasons it was so important to identify that within our report. So if you go further back into the report, you will see there were recommendations on investments made. And that would be back at the very last couple of pages of the report, page 18 and 19, and also 20. But those bring out, if you take a look at those, you'll see that Representative Erickson's bill is fairly consistent with what's requested there, or put forth as options, not really requested, but for potential investments. And so we feel that the bill lines up very well with the report that we produced and submitted to you. Stand for any questions that you might have.
Questions, members? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, I'm curious, what are the purpose of greenhouses in the production of seed? I noticed in your bonding bill you're asking for greenhouses, and how are greenhouses used in the production of seed?
I'll ask Mr. Phillips to answer that.
Madam Chairman, Representative McNamara, I think if you see there that the $600,000 portion of this bill points out that for tree improvement laboratory and greenhouse facilities, I think in the production of the new seed orchard materials, we do a lot of grafting and generation of those materials before they're outplanted and start to become orchards for future seed production. The laboratory helps to facilitate that. We don't have the capacity to do that on a broader range now at the very small greenhouse that exists at General Andrews Nursery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, I'm curious. I don't know if I can remember This supposedly is not a DNR initiative. It seems highly unusual for the DNR to be at the testifying table. Evidently, even though it says it's not a DNR initiative, they're at the table testifying and answering the questions for you. It's not a in the governor's recommended bonding bill, which I remind you takes 8 Republicans votes in the Minnesota House to pass a bonding bill. Extremely unusual. I don't know if I've ever seen this. So the DNR is testifying for a bill that the governor didn't include. In their report that we were given, it's from the Department of Natural Resources, 2014 state appropriation request, $2.8 million. Agency project priority, 15 of 22. I'm assuming this document was prepared by the department when they presented their proposal to the governor. In that document, it says, current tree seed processing operations at State Forest Nurseries have been required to be self-supporting since 1984 and thereby limited to commercially based investments. How does this bill meet that requirement? Representative Erickson.
If I could just start by your characterization of the department testifying in favor of the bill. The department is letting us know about this report, which was requested, and Representative Erickson is the advocate for the bill, as I understand. Is that true, Representative Erickson, that you're advocating for this bill?
Absolutely. That's correct.
Thank you. So let's make sure that we do not put Representative Erickson in a characterizing him in a different way than he actually is. He has been advocating for this bill.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, what's the role of the greenhouses in this bill? So, you know, you're the advocate for the bill. The department is not. I want you to walk through the $2.8 million and how it meets the requirement of the nursery be self-sustaining with the current balance in the forest nursery account, which I'm assuming you know. How does this bill meet the requirement of being self-sustaining and move us towards getting the 8 Republican votes needed to pass a bonding bill? And, Madam Chair, I'll also note that earlier there was a majority of members in the room that were Republican, and I was reminded of that by one of my colleagues, and I refused to lay this bill on the table because this discussion needs to be had. Representative Erickson, what's the $2.8 million going to be used for? How does it meet the bill, the requirements of the nursery be self-supporting? That supposedly in the report from the DNR says they support the idea of it being self-supporting. And if it's your bill, why did it start with somebody from the DNR to answer all the questions?
I think the tenor of our discussion sometimes has gotten out of hand, and I wanted to be respectful of all members for all bills. We can ask other folks in DNR. I can ask, and I would be glad to ask other folks in DNR if they can answer that particular question, or I can ask our witness, and I would ask the witness. Can you help Representative McNamara understand?
Madam Chairman, Representative McNamara, I think if you look through the report, you will see that the report clearly identifies that some of these investments that go beyond the self-sustaining nature of seedling production, which you've long been concerned about, versus private industry production of seedlings. It clearly states in the report that to undertake some of these measures cannot be undertaken on a self-sustaining basis. They were therefore identified as options to the legislature for consideration. It was the legislature that directed us to evaluate the capability to be self-supporting back in the 80s, which we did follow through and become self-supporting. At this point in time, if the legislature chose to make a decision that they were going to make investments in it, I don't think there is anything currently that precludes that decision moving forward. And so we were asked to identify potential investment options, and we have identified those options My testimony has been in the fact that Representative Erickson's bill falls well within the options that were identified to move forward and improve our response to these challenges that we're faced in the state.
I think that the question of the challenges that we are facing in the state is the important one here, and to figure out how we are going to meet those challenges and to have Minnesota native seed that is going to help us as we're dealing with climate change, droughts. Appears that we're going to face both. So this is the discussion that we need to have as responsible Minnesota legislators of how we're going to deal with those issues. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erickson, what was the largest size and number of seedlings ever produced in at Bedora Nursery compared to the production level of 6 million seedlings to date? And how, when they were producing that level, did they process the seed? Where did it come from? And why is there a requirement today that we invest $2.8 million that I guess now is not just for the seed, it's to build greenhouses to grow container plants, because that's what you do in greenhouses, which clearly the DNR has said they won't be doing, but now they've got a bill to, well, it's not their bill, I'm sorry, it's your bill, to build greenhouses. I don't even know which facility. I believe it's actually up in Dora. They're going to build the greenhouse. How does that work?
Could you repeat the question, please?
I'm wondering how is this needed with the level of production? If I'm not mistaken, DNR is not changing the level of production from today, but it needs to invest $2.8 million to stay at the same level they are at today, which is approximately 50% of the level that this facility once was at. So where is this, and why is there a need for this today if they're at such a small percentage of where they used to be?
Thank you. My understanding is that they want to streamline their operation, consolidate some of their seed sorting lines, increase their storage capacity, their cold storage capacities, with the inevitable trying to increase production to match what the need is in the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how does that relate? How did the nursery deal with it when they were bigger before?
I cannot answer that.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, my other question is, I noticed the bill, the list of the authors, have a number of folks from up on the northern part of the state of Minnesota where a lot of the conifers and such are done. And then I also went ahead and looked at one of the proponents for Representative Purcell's bill last year was the Carlton Soil and Water Conservation District, the Carlton County, which was nearby the former production facility at General Andrews Nursery. On their website, they list tree and shrub seed vendors. Only, unfortunately, two of them are in the state of Minnesota. The other ones are in Iowa, Montana, Massachusetts, and New York. One of them is a Williams Tree Seeds, listed out of Bemidji on Wilkie Loop Road in northeast Bemidji. I know, Representative Erickson, your district surrounds three sides of Bemidji, but I did Google this. It's actually in Representative Purcell's district. He's the second author on this bill. I'm wondering, how does the Williams Seed Company, what do they feel about this bill and that the DNR is going to invest $2.8 million? They're in the tree seed business. How do they feel about the support of this bill?
Thank you for the question. I don't know. I have not talked with them.
Okay. Well, that I understand. Representative Purcell is no longer on this committee, though. When we were in control of the committee, he was on it. So it's, I guess he's not here to answer the question. Madam Chair, I've got one more. Cass Lake Seed, Tree Seed Company, Cass Lake, Minnesota, another one with a 218 phone number, is in the seed cone business in northern Minnesota. Clarence and Carrie operate out of a steel building, like commonly called in our business a pole shed. They process seed for all across continental United States. How do they feel about this bill? And just to clarify, they're in Cass Lake. They're just outside your district also. They're in Representative Purcell's district. How do they feel about $2.8 million being invested to compete against them in a bill that needs 8 Republican votes?
I cannot answer that. I did not talk with them either.
Representative Erickson, if this bill didn't come, Madam Chair, if this bill didn't come from you, you don't seem to know anything about your bill. It's not a DNR initiative. Where did this bill come from? Who presented the bill to you and asked you to support it?
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
I really think that that's kind of an offensive statement.
I think so, and I'd
just like to object to that. And while I have the floor, I would like to remind McNamara, Representative McNamara, that you're patting yourself on the back for not laying the bill on the table when you had a minority shows kind of a lack of arithmetic knowledge, because as soon as there was a DFL majority in the room, the motion to take it off the table would have been in order. So I'm glad that you didn't do it, but you know, it wasn't great generosity on your part, just the simple ability to do arithmetic.
I think we are going astray in our questioning here. What I see Representative Erickson's bill doing is trying to support how many acres of forestry do we have in Minnesota?
Approximately 16 million acres of forest land.
We have 16 million, and about half of that is state-owned, if my recollection is correct. We need to maintain that forestry, and we need to maintain it with good seed stock. And I think our testifier has given us ample evidence that having good seed stock is what we need for the future, and that is what Representative Erickson is bringing to us. And I appreciate that. Looking forward for the benefit of all Minnesotans, not just certain nurseries in Minnesota who can sell to lots of other people. Representative Benson, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, and mine is less controversial.
Excellent.
looking at the report, Mr. Phillips, you know, I was looking at pages 9 and 10, table number 1, having to do with the increasing and decreasing habitat for these various species of trees. And I'm just wondering, you know, the forest industry, even though it's been in a little bit of a decline because of economics recently, is still an important industry. And looking at the changes in the types of species that will be more prevalent in the future, are the species that will become part of our environment, the new habitat for them, are they commercially viable as compared to what has traditionally been the stock here in our state?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, yes, many of them are. Some of them are less desirable than those. You know, the one of the goals of the report puts forward is this is kind of the projected actions that will occur without anything else being done. If it was just allowed, the climate continues to change and we're faced with these pressures. The hope would be that we, within some of the tree improvement efforts that we have recommended be followed, that we would be developed some of our native species that are more adaptable, find those genetic strains that are more adaptable to the climate change we are, and be able to proliferate those and maintain our native forest ecosystem that we currently have as much as possible.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I've been following the University of Minnesota Arboretum and their work. The Forest Service collaborate with, for example, the Arboretum, and I know they do a lot of work mostly on, you know, other kinds of plant materials, of course, but just wondering what are the ties, if any, between the two?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, we have worked with the Arboretum in the past. Because of some of the differentiation of species that they deal with versus the forest species, yeah, that we haven't worked that closely. If some of the recommendations are that are put forward on where we should be looking, what species to be able to produce to not only deal with the tree side of our forest ecosystems, but with the other components of the forest ecosystem and their potential restoration, I'm sure we'd be working much more closely with the Arboretum because of their experience in that area.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, why don't you give me, how do you see the development of these better strains of these species, the ones we want to try to maintain? What's the prospect of moving forward, and have you had any particular successes in the last few years in that regard?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, one of the restrictions we have is we have a fairly active Minnesota Tree Improvement Cooperative within the state out of the University of Minnesota. However, it is, you know, lingering with very little support and investment over the long term. And one of the options identified in this report is to expand the capacity of that unit, you know, with some pass-through funding for the tree cooperative to try to do this. Right now, most of that work has been focused on the commerciality of our tree species, mm-hmm, because that's where the investment dollars were supporting it. But as we talk about the adaptability and resiliency factors that are mentioned in this report, you know, we would go beyond what's commercially valuable as to sustaining these native species into the future. So at this point in time, there's been little movement on that, and it is a very long-term effort to be successful.
Madam Chair, just the last final. And then having to do with state funding, the continuation of funding over a period of time, what has been the record in regards to that in, say, the last 10 years or so as far as legislature providing resources for your agency to do this fundamental work? Has it been going up and down, or what has been the history, let's say, in the last decade?
Madam Chairman, Representative Benson, as many state programs have faced with our economic downturn that we experienced, our budgets have been slashed significantly, and along with everyone else, you know, that was what was necessary at that point in time. We see a little bit of a rebound now with last legislative session's biannual budget to provide us a little more flexibility. Out of that flexibility, however, the ability to reach the priority level of tree improvement versus just restructuring our field organization has been limited. So there's been very limited investment in tree improvement over the past, I would say, 15 years, as I look back.
Just one last question. You know, this gets to the heart of maybe of this. The whole, I don't know, maybe you won't wish to delve in this too much, but, you know, your agency's relationship with private growers and breeders, and so what is the relationship and interaction, if any?
And Chairman, Representative Benson, we have pretty good interactions. We will be actually brokering private seedlings again this year, and we have it for several years as we purchase materials that other private growers grow and have a supply of, and yet we mix into packets like our you know, songbird packets or even some of our windbreak packets. If those materials are available out of the private nursery, we will often buy those in bulk from those private nurseries and put them in our packets and then sell them that way. I think we've got a good working relationship. you know, there's always that burr over why is the state producing seedlings when the private sector is. I feel that the advantage that the state brings to the table of being in that, and this has been my long-held position, is that some of those things that just aren't commercially viable on the scale to be a private nursery produce, that's where the state's focus should be, you know, in providing the diversity of species, the diversity of genetics that may be going too far to ask a private nursery to do. With some of the container stock capabilities now, that really based upon if they can get the seed, they can grow almost anything along that line. And so that's one of the benefits of the that we see in the report of expanding our native seed capabilities is to provide that to private nurseries so there will be a more ample supply as well as a consistent supply of native materials out of our private nurseries.
Just one last one. As far as the relationship between the private nurseries and your organization, as far as the marketplace is concerned, what is the level of competitiveness as far as price, for example, in the seeds you produce compared to the private sector?
It's a very general characterization. It depends on the species being produced. I think when we talk about the production of conifers, we're pretty much on line with each other. And I think if you deal with some of the other species, and probably the most significant differential would be in black walnut, where you know our costs are probably a third of what is the average across the nurseries. And Representative McNamara, forgive me, that's pulling that number out of just past history, and I haven't looked at it currently. However, that aspect is, you know, one of the factors that we have because our legislation that establishes the nurseries in statute calls us to sell seedlings at cost, you know, and that includes trying to maintain our current infrastructure, but we do that, whereas the pressure on the private nurseries to be successful is to return profit, and that generally accounts for the differential in our cost.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I have more, but I'll leave it at that.
I think there is so much here in this report that you can have lots of questions. I am looking at page 9 and this, and I note that American basswood you expect to increase, and of course I know all the members here know that that's great for pollinators, right. So we're all glad about that. But I look at the butternut, and that's been a southern Minnesota species of great importance. Some of the most beautiful furniture in Minnesota in our history was made with butternut, and you are seeing a large decrease there. Can you just help educate us a little bit?
Madam Chairman, you know, both the potential... Actually, butternut should probably respond very well to climate change and warming. It's very similar to the black walnut species. It has a very southerly range, too. However, the impact to butternut has been the butternut canker disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has kind of devastated the butternut resource within the state of Minnesota to the point that, you know, it's considered to be a threatened species now. And so one of the things that we talk about in the report is how can we proliferate and maintain some of those genetics. And there's been none within the state of Minnesota effort undertaken to improve the butternut genetics and try to find resistance to that disease.
So we have not invested any money in preserving the butternut?
Only in taking measures on state land where we've essentially protected the remaining butternut that we have, and we've continued to try to produce butternut from as we can get available seed to continue the planting of butternut across the state.
That is something I think we as a committee should be spend a little bit more time with, perhaps not today, is understanding as we're looking at our species that are threatened. Perhaps we need to be better educated as a committee about some of these threats and what we should be doing going forward. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I think we're going to have another conversation about that at another time, but that worries me. If you could just tell us, so you actually have more than a half a dozen species listed. Are all of them in the kind of the same position as the butternut, where we haven't spent money on them, or is there something else? Is it just climate change?
Madam Chairman, most of the remaining species that are being dealt with there would be a result of climate change. Okay. And butternut is probably the exception in those large decrease ones that you see there.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm always happy to be educated, but we do have a bill before us, and I think we need to bring our conversation back to the bill. And I just am really struggling with the issue of whether or not this is a priority for the DNR. I'm looking at the list of projects here, and there are a number of other projects higher on the list than this that are not funded in the governor's recommendations. So I would like to hear more from the DNR as to whether or not this particular project has become a priority since this list was assembled.
We can certainly hear that. The legislature is a separate branch, and it may be a priority, more of a priority for us to maintain our forests and increase their viability. I know that there are some folks who would be happy to see the forests go to grasslands. I certainly am not one of those people. But if somebody from DNR would like to say something about this, but I do think it's our job to make an independent decision right now.
Morning, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Forrest Bowe. I'm the Director of Forestry with the DNR. I think Representative Torkelson's question was about, is this a DNR priority? Certainly it was not high on the list. I think you pointed out it was 16 of 22 as far as the department was concerned, if that was the correct number, and did not make the governor's cut as well. I think the testimony that you heard from Olin Phillips described if we're going to continue to process or produce the same quantities and the same species that of trees and seed that we have now, we don't need to make any changes. But should the legislature want to invest in additional species, greater diversity, provide more seed for both state use and private use, this could be an investment that you could choose.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And to one of the DNR testifiers that you mentioned, the quantities of seed and such, you know, timber is a commodity subject to supply and demand, at least the conifer portion of it, and it's been common knowledge that the demand for timber since the housing market recession back in 2008, the demand has gone down. Could you give us a kind of a 30,000-foot forecast or look ahead in terms of the demand for some of the seed? Is it stable, going down, or going up in light of the kind of the downturn in the timber industry?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the report addresses a little bit of that. One of the situations we're in and probably relates to how we move forward here and what these options are is right now, currently, there is a very low supply. We're kind of at an all-time low on some of our planting for reforestation or afforestation, and we're actually, with the boom in the agricultural demand for corn and potatoes, we're losing established lands that had been former marginal farmlands that are being converted back. So what the report points out is even though we're at this low ebb, we're on the edge of some significant factors that could radically change that demand. And if if we wait for those changes in the demand that come from climate change, with even some of what we've seen recently, the much greater storm damage across the state. We've had major areas all the way back to 1999 in the VW, then around the Sandstone area just a few years ago, up on the Bemidji corridor. So, you know, we've got to have the capacity to respond to those, and I think that that's one of the goals here. And then we're right on the edge, as many of you are aware of the introduction of emerald ash borer into Wisconsin and now into the state of Minnesota. That has a very devastating potential to our ash resource. That's 900 million ash trees or somewhere abouts there we have in the state of Minnesota. How are we going to replace those primarily ash stands as we go forward as that devastation moves? And what we've seen in other states, and hopefully we'll, through some of our efforts, we'll be able to avoid in Minnesota, is that moves very rapidly. And if you're not prepared for it, you're going to sit there and see those forest lands captured by brush species, and you'll have to be very difficult to regenerate. One of the other ecological significances that we have to address with the emerald ash borer is some of our most unique ecosystems in the state are ash swales. They used to be elm ash swales, but we lost elm out of the native component. And now if we lose ash, essentially those are going to go to, you know, the water table is going to rise because of the lack of that cover, and those sites will be lost from the former ecosystems they were. So generally the report points out that we expect an increasing demand. We're kind of at an all-time low now. And so that's not good, but it also gives us potentially time to rebound.
Representative Bacon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. First of all, I'm concerned about the list, the DNR list, particularly living where I live. Flood hazard mitigation is number three on the list. There's no money there. Quite frankly, I think that this bill is misplaced in priorities. I'm confused as to where the bill came from. I think that, you know, I've listened to Commissioner Landwehr for 3 years, and members of his staff tell me about how they want to become better neighbors and become more closely aligned with the local people and so forth. To that point, Representative Erickson or Mr. Phillips, I'm curious to know what type of outreach have you had with the private growers in the area who are currently meeting the demand for stock for trees and so forth. How many cups of coffee have you had with them leading up to the discussion on this bill and it being brought forward?
I think that is not. I think we have to watch what his role is here as we are asking questions. He is telling about a report. He is not an advocate for this bill. Representative Erickson is the advocate for the bill.
Representative Fabian, have I reached out or talked with the commercial growers to see how this might impact them 3 to 5 years down the road? No, I have not.
I think we are having this discussion that the commercial growers, the health of our forests versus our commercial growers is becoming the discussion here. Don't think that should be mutually exclusive, and it has now become seems becoming mutually exclusive, and that's not a good thing for this committee, that the health of our forests and the health of our commercial growers should be together, not saying that the health of our commercial folks is far more important. That does not seem to be helpful here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, to that point, that's what I'm trying to find out. How, I mean, it seems to me that under this proposal, either in terms of communication with or the potential impact on their business going forward, it's the private growers who have been excluded. They haven't been brought into this method, into this process. And so that's what I'm trying to find out. And quite frankly, I'm extremely concerned about this being 16th on DNR's list out of 22 recommendations. If this was a priority for DNR, they should have been bringing this forward sooner so that we had a chance to actually have some discussions back home with the people that we represent and that sort of stuff. But another question is Commissioner Phillips, you said that that you are required to sell at cost your trees. So then does the $2.8 million, I mean, in the real world, when you figure cost in your business model, if you've got to put money into infrastructure and so forth, that's a part of your cost. That's a part of your expense. Is the $2.8 million here factored into your cost?
Madam Chairman, Representative Fabian, it's not in there because it's not a current part of our process. And I think if you notice the difference here, we continue to shift into the discussion of commercial seedling production. And our commercial seedling production is self-sufficient. It's identified in the report as moving forward self-sufficient. The aspect of should the state make investments towards non-self-sufficient elements of seed production and diversity and genetics and tree improvement research, that is a question that's put forward by this report and the options that are identified. It's not expected that the state nurseries or any private nursery should bear the cost of that benefit of expanding the diversity available and addressing some of these things. As I mentioned early in my testimony, the current capabilities of seed production at our facilities is sufficient to continue to provide the needs we have at our state forest nurseries and the seedling production that we do. The options that are laid out in this report were options that if the state chose to invest towards addressing these challenges, then they would have to be investments by the state. They could not be borne on the back of the state forest nurseries now $6 million $6 million seedling production level.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Erickson, how is the private sector, these greenhouses or these growers down in central Minnesota, not northern, not Bemidji, that's central, how are they not meeting the current demand for seedlings that are needed in the market?
I would, my guess is that, and that's a bad term, I guess I really don't know. I don't know how they are meeting it. I don't know how they can meet the new genetic strains that we may need. For instance, if some of these species are like the butternut tree, are attacked by something, I don't know how much research they can do, that they can put forward to creating an alternate species for that. When the ash borer comes through, I don't know that they have the capabilities of creating a genetically modified form of that tree. I guess I cannot answer that question.
I think perhaps you're thinking about in the corn sector that is happening, but in the tree sector we do not find that happening. And so this, to keep our forests healthy, I think that's the issue here. Can we keep our forests healthy in the face of climate change and other challenges like disease? Because that's clearly been a big issue here. Did you have a final question?
Just one final. Members, I'm struggling with this. We have one of the preeminent land grant institutions in the nation at the University of Minnesota doing research and so forth on a lot of this stuff. Quite frankly, I'm skeptical of this. I'm skeptical of DNR now having kind of supported this. We have a lot of other mechanisms in place already, I believe, that can do what this bill is purporting to do. And there are a lot of other things in place already that could be enhanced rather than building new structures, rather than maybe hiring more people and so forth. We don't have other ways to deal with flood mitigation, okay? And we need to take a hard look at what our priorities really are in the state of Minnesota. And while I think of it, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call on this. I think that this is, in DNR's list, this is a badly, badly misplaced priority. And we need to take a hard look at really what we're doing. Thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm still trying to figure all of this stuff out. But I have come to understand that we have a finite amount of money and almost infinite requests for money. And I see our process as continuing to learn. We can't do them all now, so we have some short-term goals and objectives that we can accomplish. And then we're going to have some longer-term things to sort out. Not all bills that come before us are going to actually end up in law or be funded. Not all projects are going to be funded. But I see our process as key to refining what we're doing. So I appreciate the curiosity that is expressed, the interest in learning more about these kinds of things so we can go back to our constituents and learn from them, inform them about what's going on, and learn from them about what the priorities are. And we can all come together to make better decisions. So I appreciate the study and the information and the opportunity to work together with all of you, because I learned from all of you as well. My little corner of the world is not incredibly impacted directly by the forests, but my corner of the world is keenly interested in the health of the state, and the forest is part of who we identify ourselves in Minnesota. So I think I appreciate being able to pay attention to these things and to find a place for them in the bigger picture. So thanks for the conversation, because I think in vetting this, we're going to be in a better place. I just want us to do it in a way that we're working together and being respectful to each other.
Thank you, Representative Ward. In this case, we will be only sending the bill to the bonding committee. They will be making the decision about priorities. What we are doing is giving them the opportunity to consider this in their sorting process. That is all we are doing here. We are referring this bill to the bonding committee should it pass this committee. So, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, thank you for your honesty. And there's a lot of questions around this, right? And as a legislator, you know, we want to be as educated on the issue as we possibly can. Representative Ward, that's what you're saying as well. The concern that I have is that, we haven't heard from the various stakeholders about this bill and how it impacts the private sector. What work are they doing? Is this duplicative, if you will? We haven't heard that. And so, to fully vet this, like you were saying, it would have been extremely beneficial to have the various stakeholders here weighing in on this, so then we can make an educated decision on whether or not it should be moved up on the priority list. You know, when Representative Fabian talked about flood mitigation, that's a huge issue as well. Should the dollars go that direction? And so, again, when some very direct and tough questions were directed your way, and again, I just want to thank you for the honesty when you're saying, we don't have that information, or whatever the case may be. My concern is just that. We don't have that information, and I wish we did have the stakeholders here so that we could fully vet this and then make an educated decision. And for that reason, I'll be voting no on this today. Again, I wish we were able to fully vet it in that sense. Thank you.
It's time for us to vote. Did you have a final comment, Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify a couple of things. Madam Chair, I think you tried to clarify it a little bit, but Representative Erickson, you mentioned that this will give the DNR opportunities to deal with genetically modifying and finding different varieties. I just want to clarify that that's not what this is. We do not want that happening. This is about natives, more diversity within our natives. I'm sorry, you're completely wrong, and I want to make sure that we're not letting people think that this is going to get us begin to genetically modify the forest in the northern forested region. I appreciate you bringing this issue forward for, I still haven't heard, but anyway, just to clarify that, I don't know if you want to comment on that or if you want the DNR to clarify. I heard the chair clarify it a little bit, but that's not what this is about. This is about grossly expanding a facility contrary to DNR policy, but it's not about getting the DNR to genetically modify our northern forested regions. At least I hope that's not true.
I think you have stated the case. It is not true.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one more thing I still never heard before we vote. Is this a DNR priority, and do they support this?
This is the legislature's decision right now. It is not. This is Representative Erickson is advocating for this. And so I think the question, DNR had a list. You've seen the list. You know exactly what's going on. So I think it's time for us to vote. And with that, the clerk will take the roll.
Wagenius?
Aye.
Falk?
Aye.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson Paul?
No.
Benson J?
Yes, send it on.
Bly?
Yes.
Clark excused, Dill excused. Erickson?
Yes.
Fabian?
No.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Hackbarth?
No.
Hamilton?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Keel?
No.
Poppy?
Yes.
Torkelson?
No.
Ward?
There being 11 ayes and 7 nays, the motion is adopted. It is now re-referred to the Committee on Capital Investment, and we now go on to House File 2538 and would welcome Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and members.
Sorry.
Everybody at the table here, sorry. House File 2538 is the what we've started to talk about is the Farm to Food Shelf Bill, and I would like to move that to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Poppy moves that House File 2538 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Welcome, everyone.
Thank you. So House File 2538 initially has been talked about as the Farm to Food Shelf Bill. I'm going to add one word to that and say it's the Farm to Food Shelf to Families Bill, because it is kind of the whole circle. And what we're doing with food, this bill does bring millions of pounds of fresh Minnesota-grown fruits and vegetables to food shelves across the state. And the testifiers will talk about how it will touch every corner and every area within the state. It's good for farmers. It's good for rural economies. It's good for urban dwellers. It's good for the families and seniors in Minnesota who must use food shelves to make ends meet each month. It is a value-added for farmers. It does move surplus vegetables and fruits from the waste stream into the food stream, and I'm pleased to be able to present this bill, and we do have testifiers here who will speak to the specifics of the bill.
Super. Some of us have heard this before, and you're especially welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Greta Gauthier, Second Harvest Heartland Food Bank in St. Paul. We serve 41 counties in Minnesota and over 1,000 food shelves and other meal programs. We supply most of the food for those entities. Madam Chair, I have a PowerPoint here, and many of you have seen this, but not all of you. So I will just go through it fairly quickly, but I'm happy to answer any questions. So this bill is about food insecurity, and food insecurity is defined by the United States Department of Agriculture as a lack of access to enough food for a healthy and active life for everybody in the family or the household. For 11.4% of all Minnesotans are food insecure at some point. 16.6% of children and about 9% of seniors. That's each year we have 3 million food shelf visits in Minnesota. 600,000 Minnesotans live at risk of hunger. 40% of the Minnesotans served by food shelves are children. We have determined there are 100 million missing meals every year in Minnesota. So that's like missing 10 meals a month. And that costs the state over $1.5 billion a year in avoidable health care costs, in avoidable educational costs for remediation, for counseling, student productivity due to lack of attendance and other factors that come into play when children don't eat right, et cetera. One of our fastest growing groups, Madam Chair, is seniors, especially the young seniors in their late 50s and early 60s. Some of those folks became unemployed as a result of the economic shift in our country and have now either become reemployed at a much lower rate or they are still unemployed and their retirement benefits, et cetera, have not yet kicked in. So we are seeing more of those folks coming to the food shelves. We've had a greater than 70% increase in total, all seniors. But again, that 60 to 70, late 50s age is much more likely to be food insecure than the seniors that are over 80. So this 100 million missing meal gap, one way to think about that is every year the United States Department of Agriculture releases a food insecurity report. It's based on an algorithm and thousands of interviews they conduct on the phone asking people, how much did you have enough food in your house this month? If not, how much money would you have needed to buy enough food for your family? The number they came up with Minnesota most recently for our state is $250 million is needed in order for everybody in our state to be food secure. We wanted to try to get our arms around that number and what does that mean. So we hired the Nielsen company that does the TV ratings to scan barcodes of food items in grocery stores across the state. And those food items comprise what is called the thrifty diet by the USDA. So that's a diet that's like macaroni and cheese for dinner, peanut butter and jelly for lunch, not steak, not that kind of thing. And we came up with $2.50 is the cost of an average meal in Minnesota. So if you take the $250 million that is needed to eradicate food insecurity, divide it by the $2.50 for the average cost of a meal in our state, and you get 100 million missing meals. Where are these meals? Well, they're all over the state. 29% of them are in the Twin Cities urban area and 20% in the suburbs, but you can see that 40% are in rural areas outside of cities and towns. Statewide, this is what a heat map of the missing meals looks like by county. The darker the color, the more missing meals. I should point out another quick-growing or fast-growing group coming to food shelves is families that are on a working poor income. So 39% of the families that visit food shelves have at least one person, adult, employed in their family. So as I've come around to meet with all of you, I've been able to show you, because we have this data by census tract, I've been able to show you your district. I haven't been able to meet with all of you, but I still can. This, for example's sake, is Representative Paul Anderson's district out by Alexandria, Glenwood, Breckenridge, out that way. I'm not sure if it goes all the way to Breckenridge. So you can see in his district there are about 4,000 people that are food insecure, or 8% of the total population. It's much better than the state average. But they're missing about 845,000 meals every year. And for each of you, as you've seen, I've been able to show you where, which census tracts have more hunger and what is the unemployment and income in those areas. So you can see that if you look at the center column there for unemployment, in Minnesota, our January adjusted unemployment rate, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, was 6.6%. So in Representative Anderson's district, there are several areas where they're way below very good unemployment, but you still have a sizable portion of the population that is making 200% of the federal poverty level or less. The reason we put the 200% is there is because a lot of the federal programs that help families when they need food, those end when you reach 185% of poverty. So if you look at the 200%, you can see the people that are coming to the food shelves because they don't qualify for food stamps. And then this is some demographics. And in Representative Anderson's district, you can see that there are a lot of seniors living on a fixed income. And the problem there is that when seniors don't eat healthy and regular meals, the medications they're on don't work as well. And so then the problem, whatever health issues they're dealing with, tend to get worse, and then they may end up back in a care facility of some kind. And so then you start seeing the health care costs go up. Here's my other sample district is Representative Rick Hansen. I picked an urban district here south of the St. Paul. He has 3,500 people food insecure, missing about 715,000 meals a year. And for his unemployment rate, you can see that it's a little bit higher, although some areas are lower. He doesn't have as widespread as people living under 200% of poverty, but he has a couple areas where almost half the population is at that income level. Excuse me. Representative Hansen does have a lot of seniors that are low income, but also people who are new arrivals to the United States and also in the Hispanic community. So that's what hunger looks like in Minnesota, and our proposal here in this bill is that we try to address this. We say Minnesota's biggest solvable problem is hunger because we have the food we need. Every year, farmers have to plant more than they are contracted to sell for because they don't know about weather and they don't know about the length of the growing season and they don't know about international markets and all kinds of other things that make farming unique in terms of business. And so every year there are crops that are harvested but not sold and that are planted but not harvested in Minnesota. For the most recent year of USDA data, there were 210 million pounds of vegetables and fruits that were either planted and not harvested or harvested and not sold. Sometimes when they're harvested but not sold, it's because they don't meet the specification of the buyer. So, for example, for cucumbers, if the curvature of the cucumber is at an angle that's too great, buyers don't want them because when we go to the grocery store, we want to see those beautiful little straight cucumbers lined up. And if the potato has a knobby place on it that makes it look kind of not a perfect oval, then we also don't want to see those when we go grocery shopping. So those are things that we think we can bring out of the waste stream and put them into the hunger relief food stream. So our bill is a $1.5 million appropriation from the general fund to the Department of Agriculture. This would be in addition to the existing general fund appropriation. So it's a new appropriation, and it's a base appropriation. It would pass through to Second Harvest Heartland, and we, on behalf of the six Feeding America food banks that serve Minnesota, would use that money to reimburse farmers for their costs of getting these donated fruits and vegetables out of the field or off the tree, in the case of apples. We have been doing this. We wanted to test this out to see if it would work. And so we had a donation from Cargill and from General Mills. And we have been working three seasons now to try this out. And we've found that there are many farmers who are very interested in participating. They put a lot of hard work and effort into their crops, and they, of course, would like to see people eating them. And so we have also found that getting a little bit of reimbursement to help defray the cost of getting that donation out of the field is an appreciated incentive and does produce more of a donation. So we have developed a network of 93 farm operations in 36 counties across the state. We started out mostly working with some of the larger entities that we work with, like Cub Foods and Super Value and Target, and saying, where do you get your vegetables in Minnesota? So we have contacted a lot of the larger wholesalers and growers. But we also have worked with some processors like Seneca. We also have worked with Bushel Boy. And under this bill, we would continue to donate, we and the other five Feeding America food banks that serve Minnesota would donate our trucks, our drivers, fuel, insurance, our logistics, our warehouses, our pallets, all that stuff. Madam Chair, we also have been fundraising privately to support this effort. But as you may know, a lot of private fundraisers do not want to support things long-term, forever. They like to get new ideas out into the marketplace and out to see if they will work. And we think this is working really well. With the $1.5 million appropriation, we believe we can deliver 10 million pounds of fruits and vegetables. If you look at this slide, Madam Chair, you can see those carrots. You notice how fat they are, that they're seconds because they're too fat. And the potatoes, that one right in the front by the label there, it's knobby and ugly. Yeah, well, not ugly, but irregular. See, there we go. We like our pretty vegetables, right? And then if you look at those cucumbers, you can see many of them are very curved. These are actual vegetables that we collected last year from farmers in Minnesota and distributed, and we're still distributing some of them because they are able to be stored. Obviously, some of them spoil quicker, and we have to move them faster. We would be delivering these to every county in the state, and in your packet is a handout showing the food shelves and the other meal programs that have been receiving these through our pilot program. There's also a handout showing second page of that where our farmer network is right now. Madam Chair, the language in the bill also allows up to 11% of the grant for administrative expenses. That 11% number, Madam Chair, was drawn from a study that was done by the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits in 2010 that was called, their annual report. And in that report, they set forth what were the ideal levels of administrative expenses for various sizes of nonprofits. And for nonprofits that have assets over $10 million a year, which we do, the management and general expenditure norm is 11%. And I can pass this around if you would like, Madam Chair. So based on that 11% and the current appropriation amount of $1.5 million, you also have a handout of our estimated administrative costs that shows what we would plan to do should this bill see final passage, which would be wonderful and would help so many people. But we would need a program person to do some of the financial administration, verifying the donations, complying with various state laws that we would need to comply with now that we're receiving state money, and assisting with outreach and farmer solicitations, because we'd like to grow that network of farmers. Then we have an ag sourcing person who would really work on maintaining and expanding the farmer network, do a lot of the communications, do marketing, go to trade shows, the Farm Bureau annual meeting, the Farmer Union annual meeting, et cetera, and work on farmer solicitations as well. We'd also do some outreach, and we would be visiting every single farm that is participating in this, so there's some financing there for travel for farm visits. The benefits are a greater diversity of food, better nutrition, which will produce better learner and workforce productivity, less food waste, We know that farmers will spend additional funds in their own community, so the reimbursement they receive will go into local rural economies, and a statewide impact would be that the food is going to be distributed statewide. Here's a list of our supporters, Madam Chair, and we'd be happy to take any questions. I have with me Tony Manns, who is our director of sourcing, who sources all the food that we move through. Last year, just to give you an idea, we moved 83 some million pounds of food. We're the second biggest food bank by volume in the United States after Houston. And this year we're going to beat them, we think. Not that we're competitive. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. One of the things I think that we all should emphasize is we of course want to be the brain power state, and as children develop their brain power, food, consistent food is extraordinarily important, and I don't think that can be overstated. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank Chair Poppe for bringing this issue to us. I think it's a real winner. We'll have to. The funding mechanisms, of course, are going to be a challenge. But I would first like to emphasize that farmers, of course, when we produce things, we hate to see them go to waste. Mm-hmm. No farmer likes to see his product left in the field. And I would also like to emphasize that farmers that participate in this, the reimbursement they receive is strictly for their additional cost to get the product out of the field. Is that not correct? I don't know who wants to answer that.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. That's correct.
So farmers are not, you know, lining their pockets with this program. They're just getting enough money to get these products out of their field and to the food shelf where it can be utilized. Second, you know, there is a question of products, the life of these products and how quickly some of them do deteriorate. And some of them, of course, can be stored in longer term. But people need to eat year-round, of course. Is there any effort to figure out ways to preserve some of these products for longer-term use?
Madam Chair, that's a very interesting question, Representative Torkelson. I can say that that would be something that would help us move more food if we can stabilize it in terms of shelf life. One of the partners that we've worked with in the past couple of years is Seneca Foods, which does a lot of the processing for Green Giant and other companies. And we've worked, I'm going to let Tony speak to this because he works directly with them about processing.
Yes, that's a great question. I'm sorry, I'm Tony Manns with Second Harvest Heartland, and that's a great question and one that we struggle with. We do want to, that is a long-range goal of ours, is to process it and have it available all year round. Right now, we're just really focused on the lowest cost alternative, which is to distribute it fresh. In the winter, obviously, we do have limited produce available to us. We have had potatoes and carrots, and one of our other big supporters that we're just getting some delivered to us today is Bushel Boy with tomatoes. So as you know, they grow tomatoes in a greenhouse, and they sell a perfect tomato in the grocery store, and if it's less than perfect, then we receive them. So we do have access today, but we know it's going to take more funding and a little more brain power to figure out the long-term, year-round question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And along those same lines, then, is there any effort to educate the consumers that are taking advantage of these products to learn how to preserve them in their own homes?
Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson, yes, I believe that is a process that's in some flux right now. As you know, Madam Chair, some budget cuts coming down at the federal level resulted in the number of ag extension specialists from the University of Minnesota Extension being cut. Previously, those ag extension specialists had gone to the food shelves and done cooking demonstrations, you know, dispersed recipes, you know, what is this vegetable, how do I cook it? Now that staff have been dramatically reduced, that's a question that we are talking about internally, and a lot of other folks are too. I will note that the farm bill that was recently passed in Washington does have money in it for a new pilot program for what they call point-of-sale education on preparation and preservation and cooking of food. So I'm not, you know, we're in discussions right now with how do we access that money, how do we, we were out in Washington, D.C. last week and meeting with our delegation asking them to help us go to USDA and figure out with local partners what, how do we make this money come to Minnesota, or what, how can that be done? It's all very new, but you're right, it's a very important question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I would also kind of figure out how this fits into the Department of Agriculture's budget. Are there current programs in their budget that align with this, or is this kind of a brand new effort? And how does the department look at this potential addition to their work?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Torkelson. There is no program exactly like this in the department. There is a similar program that comes through Second Harvest Heartland also, which is the milk grant that has been so generously appropriated by the legislature these last few years, $500,000 a year that we use to buy milk and send to food shelves. That program, I say, is similar. You may think it's identical, but it's not, because milk we buy, it's just milk. Now we're talking about 17 different crops, so it's a little bit different situation, because we're compensating the farmer, reimbursing the farmer for their cost of getting those donated vegetables out of the field, as opposed to just buying milk. So it's somewhat different, but we have a good relationship with the Department of Agriculture, and we've been in compliance with every report they've requested. The Commissioner of Agriculture has voiced his support for our bill. Unfortunately, the bill came along too late to be included or considered for inclusion in the governor's supplemental budget. But I hope that answers your question, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Just one final question, if you don't mind, Madam Chair.
I don't mind. We have 5 minutes. I have four or three.
I can pass.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
I do want other people to be able to.
Madam Chair, can I just respond? The earlier Representative Torkelson just made the comment about, you know, farmers aren't out to line their pockets. And so the handout here is to say this is what they would be reimbursed, and it's, you know, far less. It's just a small percentage of what they would actually be receiving. So I just wanted to make that point, too.
Okay. If we could be, there are three people on the list, and we have 4 minutes. So, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Torkelson kind of asked what I was. I very much appreciate you bringing this forward, and Representative Torkelson directed it toward teaching people to preserve. I wonder if, in a world of education where we are kind of not using our HOMAC, family life sciences in school, if that is not a place that we can encourage our schools to partnership with food shelves, and maybe use some of their expertise, mm-hmm. and maybe their area, their school area, to help people to learn how to preserve
Hamilton's
products, because the more they can do it independently, the better off they and their families will be. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ward.
Thank you. We're all thinking along the same line. Having some background in education and vocational education, extension and vocational education, I was also thinking about the need for this. And unfortunately, we don't have kitchens in our schools anymore for home economics and things like that. Rare. Very, very rare. We lost most of our vocational education over the last 40 years. Starting about 40 years ago, so it's pretty rare that those kitchens. But that's a great idea.
We have kitchens.
Well, that's you are very, very fortunate. But we Neighborhood House, for instance, in St. Paul, mm-hmm. does do that kind of training and support to help people learn those skills. So it makes me think in terms, and many of our food shelves do not have space. They're in kitchen basements or church basements or something, so they don't have the space to have mm-hmm. a kitchen as such to do a training. But I'm thinking in terms of community education classes as well, to make a connection there, to do that training and development. And I've done some of those classes with people, connecting them with some of the early childhood programs. Mm-hmm. As children are in their classes, having parents participate in nutrition, economics, purchasing, that sort of thing, how to best use the resources that they have available. But then again, you need some training space and kitchens available. But I appreciate you're doing all of that, and sounds like we're all thinking along the same line. So I'm also thinking in terms of a kind of a lending library of canning equipment or something like that, so you have some training, but that people would also be able to check out the big pots or be able to reserve check-into space. You know, you have an hour or 3 hours or something, an afternoon that you could come and use that community kitchen space. Thanks.
Representative Hamilton would like a word, and so would Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, in essence of the time, I simply want to say, great bill. Thank you. You have my support.
Very good, Representative Hamilton. Representative Anderson.
Mine's almost just a short, Madam Chair. A question, I guess, for you, financial again. Has this committee been given another target for the Department of Agriculture?
We are in the process of getting money, and this will be covered. This bill will be covered. From my point of view, anyway. So that's why we're bringing it here. Representative Poppe renews her motion that House File 2538 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition?
No.
This passes. I want to thank you, Representative Poppe. I want to note for the record that when we were reporting the last bill, the vote was 10 to 7, not 11 to 7. I just want to note that for the verbal record. I just want to note for the record that we have the correct written record that the vote on the previous bill to this was 10 to 7, not 11 to 7, as I announced. And with that, members, see you next Tuesday. Plan a long day.